For the month of August, we'll be running a series of interviews I've done over the years with documentary filmmakers. In the OTM office, the producers have been referring to this collection as Bob's Docs. Over the next few weeks, we'll go through some tropes of documentary filmmaking, from prurience to access to the personal journey. But we'll start with the deadly sin of manipulation. That's the sound of the film Winged Migration, a documentary that followed migratory birds. The film would lead you to believe that we were seeing those birds in the wild, but despite the title and the footage, all is not as it seems to be. We'll be returning to that a little later. But who ensures that films hew close to the reality they claim to depict? In the documentary world, it's individual filmmakers working alone, without a clear rulebook, and with only their consciences as their guides. A few years back, I spoke with Patricia Alfterheide, a professor at American University's Center for Social Media, who told me that this approach leads to a kind of slippery slope.
When the civil rights documentary Mighty Times was produced, there was a whole segment of supposedly archival footage that was actually reenacted. There's a film called Bananas about the Dole Company's poor treatment of workers in Guatemala. And one of the lead characters in there turns out to not be what he claimed to be and to have given erroneous information.
When those ethical breaches came to light, it caused a minor scandal in the documentary world, and the suspicion that there had to be many more such breaches spooked the documentary community into creating its own ethical standards and practices. In 2009, Alfterheide and two other colleagues interviewed 45 doc filmmakers anonymously in order to find out just how gray the gray areas actually are. It turned out to be very, 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 very gray.
On a nature shoot, the cable company in question had given the crew a very short amount of time to film a predator capturing prey. And the prey in question was a rabbit, and unbeknownst to the director, the animal wrangler had actually broken the leg of a rabbit in order to let the predator capture it. And they had one more shot to do. It's getting dusk, and the wrangler then turns to the director and says, "Do you want me to break the leg of this one too?" And the director suddenly has to make a choice. And with some great soul searching says, "Yeah, go ahead." One filmmaker who was dealing with a subject whose family had all died and he didn't have any family photographs, the filmmaker went to a flea market, found some old photographs of some other family that was from the right era and the right demographic, and just slotted them in. And he said, "I'm sure 99% of the people who watched that movie thought that that was his family, and I'm not going to disabuse him, and I don't think it makes any real difference."
I was shocked. I mean, shocked, shocked, shocked to look at your study and see the examples of the way filmmakers play fast and loose with the truth in order to tell what they think is a larger story. Do they really think that telling small lies is all right if it serves a larger truth?
You are never simply delivering it to people unfiltered. You always have to make choices. You're always going to have to alter the chronological sequence in some way. You are always going to have to make tough decisions about whose story to tell. All of those things have to be owned. And so I think what people say is, I have to stay in a good faith relationship with my subjects and tell the truth to the viewer. And the problem here is that sometimes you cannot tell the truth to the viewer without in some way violating the trust of the subject. But the problem for them is that they're operating in a lonely, isolated environment when they make those decisions, and they are operating without ever having collectively clarified what those values are. Inevitably, ethical values always come into conflict with each other. It's the nature of things.
I want to ask you about the most famous rabbit leg breaker, and that's Michael Moore. Now, early in his career, I was just absolutely in awe of this guy because of his ability to get the greatest imaginable tape that was hilarious and trenchant at the same time. And then, as I laughed through Roger and Me and then later Fahrenheit 9-1-1, I realized that part of his shtick was clearly to fiddle with chronology and context in order to get the most comedic or political oomph out of a given sequence. In other words, he cheats.
Mm-hmm.
How prevalent is that sort of cheating to make a point?
I think that most documentarians are absolutely worried about the Michael Moore approach because they feel that their work is then distrusted. And that's another case for why standards and practices are so important. One of the head people at the National Film Board of Canada said to me, "We need your study because people we interview don't trust us anymore." But Michael Moore is so unusual. The growth of documentary in theaters and on television has really been much more dependent on stuff like Spellbound, Winged Migration, March of the Penguins, which have other ethical issues. I mean, those penguins don't mate for life, by the way. So those are the middle-range documentaries that do depend on a good faith relationship with the audience and that do have difficult ethical questions about the way that they've been edited and told and narrated and structured that I think we're really concerned about.
Wow. You mean penguins are promiscuous?
Penguins tend to mate for a season. Yes. It's not the love story of all time. It's just the love story of the season. Sorry.
So has anyone had to answer for that? Like, for example, the producers of March of the Penguins?
No, they haven't. Winged Migration is another example of a documentary nature film. It's about migrating birds. It's not always clear to people who watch Winged Migration that they raised all of those birds, so that those birds are not raised in nature and merely caught by the amazing French team that photographed them. They are actually part of the family.
Well, I got more than I bargained for. I find that in both instances, those examples are extremely troubling. I don't ask you to speak for the documentarians themselves, but I am interested to know, you know, how bad you believe, as a scholar on the subject, that the problem is.
I think the problem is actually very big in the most formulaic and most commercial products. They're the documentaries that are being done on the lowest budgets, the stuff on the History Channel that asks, what was Atlantis really like? It is a big problem, but I think that the people we interviewed are part of the solution to the problem because they are people whose work lives and dies on the reputation of them being honest and want desperately to articulate standards that can preserve and grow and nurture the reputation of documentary as an honest story about something real.
Patricia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Patricia Afterhida is a professor at the Center for Social Media at American University and co-author of Honest Truths, Documentary Filmmakers on Ethical Challenges in Their Work.
The father and his chick sing to one another, making sure each knows the other's voice. It is the only way the two will find each other when the father returns.
So, breaking rabbit legs and using fake props is one way to manipulate your audience. Cutting and pasting storylines to elicit the most cliffhangers and plot twists is another. In the spring of 2015, HBO aired the bombshell documentary series The Jinx, director Andrew Jarecki's inquiry into three probable murders and their elusive suspect, Robert Durst. Spoiler alert, the next few minutes will reveal more than some wish to hear, beginning with the climax to end all climaxes. And that was the film subject in a bathroom, unaware he was being recorded and apparently confessing.
Kill them all, of course.
What the hell did I do? Durst muttered. Kill them all, of course. It was a stunning denouement to six episodes of some truly gripping television, what one commentator called the true crime series we've all been waiting for. Even before it aired, Durst, the squirrely New York real estate heir, was under arrest for murder. But soon, the search for deception and manipulation shifted from the film's subject to the filmmakers themselves. Much has been made about the final confrontation between Jarecki and his subject when Durst is asked to compare a note he wrote to one of the murder victims with an anonymous letter sent to Beverly Hills police. They are in identical block letters, and both add an extraneous E to Beverly. And Durst knows the implications.
Well, I mean, the writing looks similar, and the spelling is the same, so I can see the conclusion the cops would draw. Or the writing exemplar person would conclude they were both written by the same person.
That breathtaking moment is triumphant, partly because the filmmakers have spent much of the final episode struggling on camera to get Durst to sit in for that final interview. Then, providentially, Durst calls them at his lawyer's behest because they're seeking some raw footage that might help Durst beat a charge of stalking his hated younger brother. And Jarecki thinks he's regained the upper hand.
They're saying, Bob, if you don't want to go to jail and you want to have a good defense here, you need Jarecki and Smerling to give you the defense. Obviously gives us a lot of leverage.
Thing is, the leverage, Durst's arrest for violating a restraining order, took place more than a year after the crucial interview. That is, after Durst faced the damning evidence and then wandered obliviously to the men's room in a cold sweat with a hot mic. In several ways, the filmmakers apparently played fast and loose with the timeline. What of the months that elapsed before the producers informed police of the apparently incriminating letter, and the 2 years that elapsed before they claimed to have accidentally discovered the bathroom bonanza? And yet, Durst's arrest came propitiously on the eve of the finale. Huh. The filmmakers canceled scheduled media interviews and also declined our request to appear, explaining that they didn't want to interfere with the ongoing prosecution. But the issues of documentary ethics neither begin nor end with the jinx. Joe Berlinger, with his late collaborator Bruce Sanofsky, directed a previous HBO true crime documentary, the acclaimed Paradise Lost trilogy. It also chronicled three murders, the gruesome 1993 killings of three little boys, and what was thought to be a satanic ritual. The trilogy ultimately secured the release of the so-called West Memphis Three, young Arkansas men wrongfully convicted of the crime. When I spoke to him in 2015, Berlinger told me the pressure is constantly on filmmakers to wring out the maximum drama and suspense from inherently confusing events.
You know, when you do things like stylized recreations of gruesome events for the participants who live them, when you put yourself on camera, as many filmmakers do, as the crusading investigator, you know, I get notes from networks all the time about upping the entertainment value, upping the suspense. And, you know, real life doesn't naturally fit a conventional dramatic arc. And we, as makers of this kind of work, are under increasing pressure to conform to the conventions of scripted television. That doesn't mean it's wrong. It just makes it a very interesting time for documentary.
And it's the very techniques, the ones you just enumerated, that inflate the drama, but also, upon any reflection, would tend to diminish trust in the filmmakers themselves.
I think there's a larger issue here. I mean, first of all, I believe that all filmmaking, all media, is inherently subjective. Just the process of whittling your footage down is a series of decisions. How you choose to frame your shot, you low angle, you know, suggests one thing, a high angle suggests another.
In fact, in Paradise Lost, there's this one moment where you capture the stepfather of one of the victims, a guy who is a part-time clergyman. And there's a shadow of one of the pieces of, I think, of recording equipment on his forehead that looks very much like a pentagram. And, you know, it's to gasp to see that, especially as the story plays out.
Well, I mean, that was a true found moment. It was around Christmas time. They were putting a miniature Christmas tree on the grave of their newly deceased son. And because of the angle of the sun and the angle of the head of that stepfather, it reversed the image of the star that was on top of the Christmas tree to being an upside-down star, which is what a satanic pentagram is. It was a chilling moment to observe and a chilling moment in the film.
Your style of filmmaking is to simply let the camera do the talking. You have no audio narration. Every now and then you insert a title card to set time and place, a little bit of context, especially when there's been quite a bit of elapsed time. But you do show up in the film Paradise Lost. That is in the form of a conversation where a possible murder weapon is being examined in court, and the source of the murder weapon was you guys.
At the grave of the deceased son of one of the stepfathers. We were given a knife by him as a present, which was an unusual present to give, on Christmas Eve. And when we went back to our hotel room, we opened that knife up, and there was blood in the hinge, and it was a serrated knife. And these children had multiple stab wounds on them that were consistent with a serrated knife. And so we were confronted with a serious ethical dilemma. You know, was this a potentially a piece of evidence? What do we do? Do we violate this relationship that we have with our subject by turning this knife over? What would that mean for the film? You know, we felt that if we turned this knife over, it would undoubtedly shut the film down because the filmmaker-subject relationship is so important in gaining and maintaining access that we felt that this would really be kind of the death knell of our project. Within 24 hours, we were back in New York, meeting with various executives and legal representatives at HBO, and collectively we made the decision that good citizenship trumps any filmmaking need, that doing the right thing was more important than our film project, and that if we had come into possession of a potential piece of evidence, we had a moral obligation to turn it over.
And yet the filming continued. You took your project to fruition, and then in two subsequent installments. How did the fact that you became a participant in the investigation altered the filmmaking process?
The first film was purely an exercise in cinema. You know, we came to film a story as it was unfolding. And because we thought we had witnessed this incredible miscarriage of justice, we assumed that the first film was going to have a major impact on the case. And when the film was ignored by the authorities and the outcry was ignored by the authorities in Arkansas, we felt we had a duty to make a second and a third film. And that's when we passed from, I think, neutral filmmakers to advocates. And the second and third films are, I think, pieces of advocacy, where the first film, I think, is a piece of journalism. And that's the difference.
How much directorial license have you to fiddle with sequence of chronology and to exclude certain complicating facts in order to make the story more understandable, more seamless, and more powerful?
Any documentary is a compression of time. You know, presenting a 6-week murder trial in Paradise Lost in a 2.5-hour film is a compression of time, which is by definition a manipulation of chronology. That's a given. But what is not acceptable, in my opinion, is overtly telling an audience that something happened on this date when in fact it happened on another date. And so it's a delicate dance, but that's the difference between a good documentary and a bad documentary. There's a fine line between exploitation and investigation, and you always have to be aware not to tip into the exploitation part of the equation.
We discussed the scene where the star on the top of the Christmas tree at the gravesite cast a shadow of a pentagram on the head of one of the grieving step-parents. And an hour and a half later, you come to realize that, holy moly, I think this guy might be the killer. Did you withhold anything from the audience for the sake of the ensuing drama?
If you're asking me, do documentarians and do I selectively withhold information until the right dramatic moment, the answer is yes, because you can't present every moment at the moment it happens, because mathematically you can't show your entire story at one moment. There is a thing called running time of a movie that you have to fill. You have to thread the needle in such a way that you keep your audience and that you have an unfolding narrative. I mean, that's called filmmaking.
So on the subject of unfolding narrative, when Andrew Jarecki unfolded the probably incriminating evidence of a Robert Durst penned envelope next to an apparently Robert Durst penned letter to the Beverly Hills police, which would have made him, in his own words, the only possible killer, that happened a couple years earlier than we were perhaps led to believe. Did that, as a filmmaker, make you squeamish?
Good question. I am not in favor of giving false information to an audience. for obvious reasons, but I am okay with holding off giving information until the right dramatic moment, because that is the nature of storytelling.
If I haven't misheard you, there is a structural conflict between the role of a documentarian to seek truth and his responsibilities as a filmmaker to spin out the most compelling narrative. Is it possible to do both to the utmost at the same time?
A documentarian must be committed to a truthful presentation of the facts. But in my book, emotional truthfulness is a valid form of truthfulness. You want to give the emotional truth of a situation. Chronology gets manipulated by the act of filmmaking. It doesn't mean you can overtly manipulate chronology. A documentary needs to have balance, but it doesn't mean you need to put every fact and to counterpoint every fact, because then the film would be endless. It's a series of decisions. And I think what separates good documentaries from bad documentaries is finding that balance between truthfulness and storytelling.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to episode one of our summer series, Bob's Docs. Next, a harrowing journey to the deserts and meth labs of the Mexican-American border. I'm Bob Garfield.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.